Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money Podcast for the Labor Day weekend, September 2nd, 2011. Unemployed Americans already have plenty to worry about, and now companies with help wanted signs are adding to those worries.
An employment agency or an employer is going to look at a resume, look at an application, and may say, this person hasn't worked for 6 months, I'm not interested.
And a good Labor Day to you, too. Here in Los Angeles this week, thousands waited in line at a job fair for a chance to work.
2.5 years I've been looking for full-time employment. Like everybody else here, I'm struggling and I'm looking. You definitely have to stay proactive and you have to keep your options open.
Plus,
there are no personal phone calls allowed. We do, however, allow for emergencies. If you make an emergency phone call without asking, you may be let go.
Author Daniel Orozco's Workplace Orientation for the Recently Hired. Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
So once again, we find ourselves, third year in a row actually, with a Labor Day weekend that doesn't merit a whole lot of celebration. This month's federal unemployment report showed no jobs added to the economy. 6 million Americans are long-term unemployed, out of work for 27 weeks or longer. And as if they don't have enough to worry about, an ugly trend has surfaced. Want ads that explicitly tell the unemployed they are not welcome to apply, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Jared Anderson's 28, and he's come to the Oregon Job Center in Portland to check on his unemployment benefits.
Been unemployed since December 27th.
What work were you doing?
I was doing medical device sales, kind of like a spinal fusion enhancement device.
Okay.
My brother's been trying to get me to go work somewhere in Tampa, Florida.
After I spoke to Anderson, I poked around at careerbuilder.com, and I found this job, Medical Equipment Sales, St. Petersburg, Florida. Only it says in bold caps, must be currently employed, or you won't get an interview and your resume will be deleted. I found similar ads that exclude the unemployed for restaurant managers in Atlanta, Houston, and Iowa City, a service manager in New Jersey, an executive assistant at a New York hedge fund. Those listings would be illegal under legislation proposed by Democrats in Congress.
The law would outlaw refusing to hire or consider someone simply because the person is unemployed.
Christine Owens of the National Employment Law Project says that would prohibit an employer from a blanket ban on unemployed applicants, but that's as far as it would go.
It doesn't mandate the hiring of the unemployed. It doesn't reduce an employer's unfettered right to limit a job opening to someone who meets qualifications.
I don't think explicit discrimination where companies out and out say they just won't hire anybody who's been unemployed for longer than 6 months is a common practice.
That's John Challenger of outplacement firm Challenger, Gray & Christmas. He says most companies don't want to be caught openly dissing the unemployed. In fact, none of the employers running those ads returned my calls. Several other companies flatly denied they'd ever favor employed people in hiring. And yet, says Challenger, scratch the surface?
More quiet discrimination or concern on the part of companies about people who've been out of work for a long period of time is a real factor.
Jared Anderson feels it in his job search.
The longer that you're unemployed, yes, the worse it is, because they'll just start to look at you and ask, why are you still unemployed? Is it that you're unemployable?
John Challenger says even if outright discrimination in recruiting is banned, these doubts will remain in recruiters' minds.
Whether conscious or unconscious, they look at longer-term unemployed and they worry whether that person's skills are current, whether or not that person has become complacent or just doesn't have the kind of urgency to find the job, and would that translate into the work environment?
Anderson at the Oregon Job Center has a ready explanation for his long stint of unemployment.
Well, I took it as an opportunity to kind of explore and see where it is that I would like to find employment.
Vanessa Reakin just got laid off from a retail job. She lost 4 jobs in quick succession when the economy tanked in 2009. She knows a job history full of gaps is a red flag.
So I found that the most effective way to thwart that is to include in your cover letter, you know, I am a diligent worker, unfortunately due to economic circumstances, etc., etc.
John Challenger says that etc., etc. should include anything you've done to further your career or just keep busy while looking for a job, training, consulting, volunteer work, even caring for a family member. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace Money.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. This idea that being unemployed somehow makes you unemployable, that is not an acceptable idea to any of the folks I met this week at a job fair in South Los Angeles. On any other day, the Faith Dome at Crenshaw Christian Center would be home to prayers of all kinds. But it's safe to say that on Wednesday, the prayers, hope, crossed fingers, good luck wishes, all focused on just one thing. Please let me find a job.
Ladies and gentlemen, in Section H, as you go out to the job fair, please note that there is a line.
The event was called For the People, one of several held in cities across the country, organized by the Congressional Black Caucus. Spokeswoman Stephanie Young told us more than 7,000 people had filed through the church doors before 1 o'clock that afternoon. We asked a few of them, almost all were African Americans, to tell us their stories.
My name is Brenda Williams. I'm a native here of Los Angeles, California, and I am here to get the job waiting for me.
What is your current job situation, your current employment situation?
Well, I've been unemployed now for 8 months. I am a job developer. I have taught what I'm here to do today.
So 8 months ago, you were counseling people on how to find a job.
Absolutely. Creating job clubs, teaching them how to dress, how to prepare.
What has the job hunt been like for you?
Job seeking has been difficult. You have to have a strategy. Now, my strategy was not to be here, but I got a phone call early. I went down to the WorkSource Center, and they said, do you know about the job fair today? And I wasn't going to come, but that little voice in my mind said, you better go. So that means there's a job here for me today, and I'm going to get it.
Thank you for your patience. Have your card out so that you can turn it in as you exit the door. A new opportunity waits for you right outside. Have your card out so that you can turn it in as you exit the door.
Brenda, by the way, is 49 years old. Alexander Richardson, 47 years old from L.A., was in a group that would be next to exit the church for the parking lot, where potential employers sat in tents. He's been working off and on for about a year and a half in temporary jobs after getting laid off from a supervisory position in a warehouse.
Well, it's been an up-and-down roller coaster because I work when and where I can, but, you know, I'm looking for some way more permanent.
How did you survive without a paycheck, or at least not a permanent paycheck for that long?
Well, I had to get government assistance, and I had to find out wherever they were giving out food or whatever, because you have to make means where the means are necessary, and I made do. I kept the faith, and I knew that, you know, God had a place for me to be, and all I had to do was keep one foot forward, and I would get to that place eventually.
He says his dream job would be something in marketing or sales.
All right, here we go, you guys. We're just about next, so I want you to be encouraged, motivated, and stimulated. Let's hear it for A section.
Outside, we found more job seekers, also seeking shelter from the sun and heat in between visits to the tents. 63-year-old Josephine Cobbs, also from L.A., decided a couple of years ago that she would go back to school and get her bachelor's degree. She supported that effort with a blue-collar job at the Staples Center. Then she was laid off.
As a student, you can't really focus on your studies if you can't pay your rent. So that's what brought me here today. But I'm still working to stay positive. I'm going to get back to school. I'm going to complete my degree.
How long have you been actively looking for a full-time job?
Since my hours were cut, which was 2008.
What have those 3 years been like for you?
Well, I've made them a positive because I've been doing a lot of volunteer work.
But you can't live on a check for volunteer work.
But guess what? I found out if you don't get up and you don't stay active, you lose your enthusiasm and you can become very depressed because of the situation. And on top of that, when you put volunteer service on your resume, it really is a positive to employers because they feel, well, you're not just sitting around waiting for a job to come to you. And one day, with my volunteer work and skills, you never know. Someone may offer me a job.
Okay, if you're just entering, please note that the agents and booths are back.
Michelle Johnson traveled all the way from Riverside to attend the fair. She is 41 and was laid off from a banking industry job 2.5 years ago.
I've had a part-time jobs in between, but yeah, 2.5 years I've been looking for full-time employment. It's been 2.5 years of some of the biggest challenges you're going to see. Unemployment, it's helped a lot, you know, because of the extensions, but when an extension runs out, you're out of luck.
So how have you been able to manage with your finances?
Not very well. Family and friends support, but not very well. I'm struggling. Like everybody else here, I'm struggling and I'm looking.
What kind of job are you looking for?
My background is banking. Admin is what I do. So I'm looking for anything where I can utilize the skills that I've learned in banking. You know, customer service, computers, trying to pretty much crossing industries to try to make myself more employable.
How have the last 2.5 years changed what you see your life is going to be like down the line?
Well, I can definitely say that it's made me realize that you definitely have to stay proactive and you have to keep your options open. You know what I mean? I don't know of anyone that thinks that there is a such thing as job security anymore. Pretty much everybody that I know, we joke amongst ourselves that you always keep your resume ready and always keep it updated.
Thank you for speaking with us and best of luck to you today.
Thank you. You have a great day.
As we wrapped up our conversation with Johnson, a Latino gentleman sitting just behind her and to the left indicated he'd like to speak with us, and he had a fairly large grin on his face.
Well, my name is Pedro Baez. I'm from Harbor City, California, and today, after 16 months of being unemployed, I have a job. I've been hired. I'm going to be starting work with an employer that looked at my resume and said, this is exactly what we're looking for. You will fit in as a financial planner. How much better can you do than that? I got laid off on May the 5th, 2010 at 10 o'clock in the morning. I was ready to go back to work that very same day at 10:01. Been looking since that time. I've had about 30 interviews, no job offers, and I was beginning to think that it wasn't going to happen, that perhaps maybe my employment career after 30 years was over. But today, I felt inspired based upon what I heard last night from Congresswoman Waters, that the one thing that these employers promised not to do would be to discriminate because of age. And I am one of those senior citizens, 61 years of age, and I'm unemployed, but as of a few moments ago, I am now employed, and I am very happy.
At least for Pedro Baez, this will be a Labor Day worth celebrating. Some former military personnel are finding it tough to transition from the battlefield to the workplace.
I got out of active duty last year, and I've been unemployed for almost a year. There's chaplain jobs, but not chaplain assistant jobs on the civilian sector.
That story later after your calls on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it is time now for your questions. Helping us out this week is David Lazarus, consumer columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Hi, David.
Hey there.
Haven't seen you for a while.
Too long. I think I've overstayed my welcome, and you just don't invite me back enough.
Oh, no, not at all. We've missed you terribly.
No one else sings, I guess, on this show.
Well, yeah, and hopefully we won't either.
Oh, okay. All right. I didn't get the memo on that exactly.
You know, earlier in the show, we heard about the difficulty that unemployed folks are having getting a new job because they're unemployed. This has to be a fairly new phenomenon.
I think it is, and I think basically what we're seeing is the stigmatizing of the unemployed, that it's just become so chronic that employers just sort of look at an unemployed person these days as tainted goods,
right,
which is wrong.
And, absolutely.
And I want to emphasize that so many people are out of work, not through any fault of their own. It's just victims of circumstance.
So I'm not sure exactly how to ask you this question, but are there ways to cover up the fact that you don't have a job currently when you're applying for other jobs? I don't know, do some volunteering, put that on your resume?
Well, and I think you're onto something there. I think, first of all, honesty is still the best policy.
Always.
And the last thing you want to do is try and finesse this in some way so that an employer thinks you're trying to pull a fast one.
Because they'll find out.
Yeah, they'll find out. These people are not stupid. They've seen them all. And the last thing they want to do is hire somebody who is coming in with any sort of air of being duplicitous or dishonest. So be straight. You know, if you've been out of work, you say you've been out of work, but you explain how that happened. My company was downsizing. It was explained to me by my manager that it wasn't because of my work. Whatever you have to say, you're not alone there. But that said, yeah, you're right. You don't want to be seen as somebody who's been spending unemployment sitting on the couch watching Wheel of Fortune the whole time.
No, which we know that is not the case for people, but unfortunately, perhaps that's a perception?
It could be. You know, who knows? In any case, I think what you want to do is give an air of productivity, and that's not impossible. Community service is one thing. Volunteering, food pantries. I mean, there's so many things right now that you can do with your time that are constructive and contribute to society. That's a good thing. Also, you can, you know, do something on your own, even if it's just blogging or something else in which there's no money whatsoever, but it still demonstrates an element of productivity, even measurable productivity in this case, because you can say, well, you can take a look at my blog, and I've been writing about my industry, haven't made any money from it, but I've been keeping abreast of developments in this industry and commenting upon them, and this shows that I've been doing that. And I think a potential employer would say, boy, that not only does that show initiative, but here's somebody who's not out of the loop.
All right. Let's move to the phones now. And Dave is with us from Santa Cruz, California. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Tess. How are you?
Good. How are the waves out there?
There are no waves. I even got up extra early this morning to go out, and there were no waves.
What is going on?
I don't know. We usually have the best surf on the California coast.
I know. I've watched the folks there many, many, many a time.
Well, maybe all the big waves went to the East Coast with the storm.
And, yeah.
And so that's it. They just went over there, and then they'll come back.
Exactly.
they'll make their way around. Now, I have to tell you, I have a note here from my producer who tells me that you were pulled over by the police recently and it was our fault? What?
You know, I would love to lay the blame on you guys, but I really can't.
Okay. Good.
Your producer called me on my cell phone and I was driving and I answered my cell phone, not hands-free. And he wanted to ask me a few questions, and I said, yeah, sure, whatever. I was only going 2 miles down the road, and naturally, that's when I got pulled over.
Well, did you tell him you were listening to Marketplace Money?
No.
That's the card I would have played.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Works for me every time.
Or I know Tess Viglin. Oh, please, right this way, sir.
I've got Tess on the line. I can't talk right now.
Well, how can we help you out today? I promise we will not fine you for anything that you say.
Okay. Several weeks ago, I was listening to your show, and there was a woman who came on, and she said that she had great credit rating because her parents had put her on her credit card when she was like 3 years old.
As an authorized user?
Right. And so that got me thinking, because I have a 4-year-old and a 2.5-year-old. And that got me thinking, what are some of the things that I can do now, but even as they grow up and into their teens and that sort of thing, what can I do to help establish their credit rating and, you know, and even just more generally, you know, their sense of saving and proper use of money and that sort of thing?
You know, David, I have to tell you, my first reaction to this mm-hmm. is I don't know why we're so obsessed with our credit scores that we're worried about getting them taken care of for small children.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there has become this obsession. And I understand it's a very important number, one of the most important in your life. But really? I mean, do we need to be putting kids as authorized users on their parents' cards when they're 4 so that they have a long history when they graduate college?
You know, the question here really is, when do you introduce plastic into the life of your kid? And the jury's out on that. Different parents have different ways of approaching it. For a long time, it had been thought, well, you don't really want to give a credit card to a kid until they're 18 because it's like handing them a gun. You know, you don't want them to use it irresponsibly. But at the same time, Dave's on the right track by just wanting to introduce some money sense to the kids. And so that's something you want to do early. For instance, with my son, who's still very young, he just turned 10, but he's already got a savings account. And I encourage him to put money in there as opposed to the little jar that he keeps at home where he saves up for his video games, which is you know, that's his disposable income. But I want him to understand that there's a longer term idea as well to money management.
But Dave Collar, I'm sorry, I just realized now that I have two Davids. Dave Collar, I think, is talking about this notion that if you put your kids on as an authorized user of your card when they are, say, 2 years old, then it is going to give them a long credit history, which helps out with the credit score later on when they end up using credit cards.
I don't know. Are the credit agencies that dumb?
Yes. All right.
I'd like to think that they're not, and I'd like to think also that that kind of thing just is self-defeating. But really, the important thing here is teaching your kids about credit and teaching. I mean, you know, so what Dave is describing, what you're talking about here is just sort of this gaming of the system.
Exactly.
And I don't have a comment on that because if it works, well, that's shameful. And if it doesn't work, you're wasting your time. I just don't like it either way.
Yeah.
So I would say, you know, it's not something I did. It's not something I would encourage anybody to do. And I would think that over the long run, if these credit agencies are in any way have their act together, they're going to look at your file and say, geez, you were 2 years old when you started into the world of credit. You must be a really smart person. No, they're not going to say that. And I'm going to get back to the other thing, and that is you do need to introduce plastic into your kid's life at some point. I think 18 is too late. I think 16.
Really?
I think 16 is the time. They've got their driver's license for the first time. They're taking on adult responsibilities, really, for the first time. They're understanding that there are consequences in life. Obviously, you're going to want to place limits on a credit card. You don't want to make it carte blanche and say, go to Vegas, have a good time, you know, more power to you, son. No, you don't want to do that. But I think 16 is a good time to start those lessons. And also, you still got them under your thumb a little bit at that point. So you can talk about things. You can keep things under control a little bit more. But it is crucial that you, the parent, take responsibility and take the incentive in trying to teach good credit management. Because otherwise, once kids get out on their own with all that independence and suddenly all that freedom, they can get in way over their head with credit.
Right, which is what happened to me when I was a young man.
You and me both, Dave.
So what? How long does it take to establish a really good credit rating?
Not as long as you might think, to be honest. When I was starting out in the world of credit, I was worried about that. It was before I had bought a car, and I really wanted to have good credit. I wanted to really get that thing going so that one day, when and if I was going to buy a house, I was Mr. Credit.
Right.
I don't think it takes years and years and years and years and years. What it takes is a pattern of good behavior. In other words, you have your credit, you are making your payments on time, you are responsibly managing any balance that you're carrying, and you're not showing yourself to be an untoward risk. That is what the world of credit is looking for.
Okay, yeah, that's really helpful, actually.
All right. Thanks so much for the call, Dave.
All right, thank you, guys.
All right, and we are going next to Anna from Baltimore. Hi, Anna.
Hi, how are you?
How bad did Irene hit you guys?
Oh, man, I'm out of cable and internet. It's really tough here.
Oh, no. Cable. Oh, no.
No, I'm just teasing. Yeah, but a lot of people are without power, but we're just about fine. Not nearly as bad as they had as it had threatened.
Now, Anna, there had been a lot of talk about this storm being overhyped, but I'm from the better safe than sorry school when it comes to disasters.
Yeah, amen.
I agree.
All right, so what's your question for us today?
Okay, so I'm recently engaged.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. My fiance and I are considering combining finances. He is an excellent saver with no debt, and I am a relatively poor saver with much debt. So
boy, they say opposites attract, don't they?
Yeah, that's for sure. So luckily, I have no credit card debt. It's all school debt. I've got about $12,000 in undergrad at 3% and $54,000 from grad school at about 4.4%.
Okay.
So he feels that, you know, debt is just, an anchor around your neck, and you can never really save anything as long as you're in debt. So he
wants to get rid of that school debt.
Yep, that's right. Yep. But he's also thinking that we'd like to buy a house in the next 3 years. So we're just wondering, is it the best thing to do to pay it off and deplete our cash by about half?
Boy, here, David, another question that we get all the time about the priority of spending and where to put the extra money that you may have. My first question for you guys is whether you have an emergency fund ready to go.
Yes, we do.
Okay, so that's taken care of. So would you, if either of you lost a job, would you be able to live for how long? without running into trouble?
Probably about 1 year.
Oh, that's good.
Wow,
that's good
for you.
Yeah, I think Anna is weighing saving for the future versus taking care of business now.
Right.
And Anna, my first reaction is I want you to give your fiancé a hug and a kiss on my part because he's got his head on straight when it comes to money. I'm totally a debt hawk like he is. I don't like that dark cloud hanging over me. I like the relative freedom that comes with knowing that I'm not beholden to anybody. And I think your fiancé is a smart cookie, and you're a smart cookie for marrying somebody who's a smart cookie. So it all comes around. But now back to the big question, and that is, how much urgency is there to pay down that student debt? And I think the answer there is, to all things, moderation. Debt is something you want to tackle, and you don't want to tackle it slowly. That's how the industry wants you to do it. You want to get out from under the debt rock, and that should be a priority, but not to the exclusion of all else. Because if paying down your debt becomes the sole focus of your financial life, you're basically not going to be ready for any of the curveballs that life throws you, nor will you have the freedom to do what you want as newlyweds, presuming this all goes according to plan. There's going to be expenses coming up in your life. You want to be able to say, well, I do want to get that McLaren stroller as opposed to that Costco stroller. You know, I mean, these are the things that you are going to be facing, and you don't want to feel like you're scrimping and saving just because you're still dealing with the debt. So the bottom line is, deal with the debt. Maybe even accelerate whatever payments you have now, or overpay, you know, by giving even a little more each month. But do not take all your disposable income and throw it at the debt, because you're going to want to use some of it for other things.
Yeah. Okay, that sounds great. I love the idea.
All right. Well, thanks so much for the call.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And finally, we have Nathan in Martinsburg, Pennsylvania. Hi, Nathan.
Hey, how are you doing?
Very well. How are you doing there?
Pretty good.
What do you do there in Martinsburg?
Well, right now I'm on a leave of absence from the school that I was attending. I'm just trying to sort out some things in my life and figure out what exactly I should be doing before I commit to anything. But I haven't gone into debt yet, and I figured before I entered into this second semester, I want to look, is what I want to do practical? How can I be responsible with what little I have?
Well, it sounds like he wants the money 101 talk. Nathan, do I have this wrong? I mean, you're basically getting launched on the world of money, and you want to know how to do it right.
Right.
I think what you want to be keeping in mind is, it's best to learn the landscape as a money user and as a money consumer. And that means, as a saver, you want to know, you know, where are you going to get the best interest rate? As an investor, it means what products will be available for you. And you don't want to get your feet too wet too quick there. You want to look at index funds. You want to look at bond funds. You want to look at those plain vanilla investments that'll give you a taste of how the marketplace works. And then it's a learning curve. How much disposable income do you have at the moment? What kind of money are you playing with?
Well, I have a college savings account with about $7,000 or $8,000 in it, which can only be used for anything college-related.
Good.
Aside from that, I just have what I'm making from my job, and I budgeted out that so that I can still live, but I'm not spending paycheck to paycheck. I'm trying to put away, you know, for an emergency fund, for saving up for whatever else I don't know I'll need in the future.
Okay, well, that's all laudable. And, you know, I would advise that at some point when you can scrape up, let's say, $1,000, go to some brokerage of your choice, buy an S&P 500 index fund, buy into that, and that'll give you the broad stock market, and then make a point of reading the business section of the paper, looking at the financial websites that are out there, and start familiarizing yourself with what your money is doing day to day. The real world experience of watching your money out there performing or not performing, you'll get a good sense of how finance works.
Where is the best place to start if I'm taking out loans to go to school?
I guess I would say there's a really good website called finaid.org, and we'll have a link to that on our website.
Okay.
That'll give you a whole good background on what kind of loans are available, what they mean to you, that sort of thing. So does that help you out?
That helps a good bit.
I have a great way for you to continue your education.
Okay.
Keep listening to the show.
I've learned that a lot over the past years.
All right. Thanks so much for the call.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right, we are here to take your money questions. Give us a call at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email. You can find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. David, thanks as always for being here.
My pleasure.
And do remember to always check with your own financial professional before making any big money decisions.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
My name is Kelsey Martinez. We're right now on the Music Center campus, downtown Los Angeles. My wallet is brown. It's a fossil. I believe it came from some generic department store. I have assorted key cards for entry into places. Business cards for people I don't recall, just in case it rains productions. There's a little free advertisement for them. I'm going to promptly clean my wallet after this experience. A couple of credit cards. I have a Charlie card for Boston. A Charlie card is basically just like it's a public transportation in Boston, so they're, you know, Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority. The T, as they call it, I believe. I used to have a beau in Boston. I lived in New York, so I would often visit him. And when I would go to Boston, I would take the T around. So there's absolutely no logical reason for me to still have it. I'm a cheapskate. I think there's a dollar on there. And if I'm ever in Boston, I can get on the T. Or at least pay for a part of a trip on the T.
Interviewing for a job probably means sharing some personal information. I said some.
I'm a 44-year-old man sleeping on my brother-in-law's living room sofa, and if I don't get a job by the end of the month, the punk is going to toss me out on my ass.
A day at the office with writer Daniel Orozco, coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Back to our labor coverage this holiday weekend. We visited one job fair earlier this hour, filled mostly with African-American job seekers who face a national average of 16% unemployment. Joblessness is also high for military veterans trying to rejoin the workforce. The average unemployment rate for vets of Iraq and Afghanistan is 12.5%. In some states, it's as high as 23%. So this week, when President Obama spoke to the American Legion Convention in Minneapolis, he outlined the administration's commitment to help.
I propose a returning heroes tax credit for companies that hire unemployed veterans and a wounded warrior tax credit for companies that hire unemployed veterans with a disability.
With more troops returning home, we asked Marketplace's Jeff Tyler to visit the front lines of veterans unemployment at a job fair just down the freeway in Culver City.
Thousands descended on the Sony movie studio looking for work. These weren't actors pretending to be soldiers, but the real deal. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce has been sponsoring job fairs like this one just for veterans. People like 38-year-old Monica Feraldo.
I got out of active duty last year, and I've been unemployed for almost a year.
Her last job was as a chaplain's assistant. She did a tour in Afghanistan and counseled hundreds of soldiers. But her skills aren't much appreciated outside the military.
There's no chaplain assistant jobs. There's chaplain jobs, but not chaplain assistant jobs on the civilian sector.
Okay, a chaplain's assistant is an unusual position. But even for the most common jobs, there's a disconnect between the military and civilian workplaces.
The problem is that the skills and the training you received in the military are not always transferable to the civilian workplace.
Joe Sharp directs the economic division of the American Legion, the nation's largest organization for veterans. Sharp says many civilian jobs require specific certifications, and those can vary from state to state.
If you're trained as an auto mechanic in the military, a lot of states won't recognize that certification or that type of work, and then that veteran has to start all over again.
These certification requirements can create major setbacks. Former military accountants, air traffic controllers, and medics all have to relearn what they've already been trained.
As a medic, we're trained to do everything from trauma life-saving that you would see a paramedic doing.
That's 22-year-old Balreet Kara. Everybody calls her Bree.
I was in Iraq for a year and a half, and I was a line medic, so I was attached to an infantry unit.
Now, as a National Guard medic, she teaches life-saving skills to soldiers at Camp Roberts, California.
Got a soldier down! Where are you going to tie a tourniquet, sir?
The highest point of the injury. Where are you hit? Right here? Right here?
On top of being a teacher, Bree is also a pre-med student. Her experience as a medic doesn't count as credit toward her degree.
It goes to waste because you have to do all this training all over again, even though you know and you have the skill set to do up to what an RN can do.
Money from the National Guard helps pay her tuition, but it doesn't cover everything, so Bree needs another job. At the job fair, she passes out resumes to the reps from the VA, the Red Cross, and Cedars-Sinai Hospital.
They took it, and they said they have an administrative position open. They don't have anything medical, but I mean, that's fine. As long as I get my foot into the door, that's really what matters.
There's another door, an invisible one, that can be even harder for vets to open. Companies don't talk about it publicly, but privately, they tell Joe Sharp with the American Legion.
They have expressed concern the expense of taking on a veteran that may have some sort of injury, PTSD or physical injuries, and what that will do to the cost of their health insurance.
Sharp says companies don't realize the VA covers all medical costs for the first 5 years after someone leaves the military. So what does that mean for the company's insurance costs?
They can actually save money.
To motivate employers, President Obama recently proposed tax credits for companies that hire unemployed vets, plus more help for service members re-entering the job market.
I'm directing the Departments of Defense and Veterans Affairs to design what we're calling a reverse boot camp to help our veterans learn about everything from benefits to how they can translate their military training into industry-accepted credentials.
The policies, the tax breaks, the job fairs, all positive steps. But sometimes they're still not enough. I checked in with Bree a month after the job fair. She expected to get calls about entry-level positions from two or three companies.
I didn't hear back from any of them.
Monica Feraldo, the chaplain's assistant, found a job, but it's pretty far out of her field. She's working as a temp. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace Money.
With all these millions of Americans looking for work, nobody really wants to hear it if you're not happy with the job you have. But a lot of us have been there, right? Worst job you ever had?
I was happy in the haze of a drunken hour, but heaven knows I'm miserable now. I was looking for a job and then I found a job, and heaven knows I'm miserable.
My worst job, probably a dishwasher. Just had to wash a whole lot of dishes, and I don't like washing dishes, and just had to stay extra. Just suck, you know? I'd rather not wash dishes.
Worst job I ever had was my first job in 1997, my senior year of high school. I'm 5'1", they made me clean shelves I can't reach. And when I left to go to college, they said, "Oh, we didn't know you were a minor. You were supposed to get half-an-hour breaks instead of 15-minute breaks. You didn't know I was a minor? You have my driver's license."
I was a carpenter insulating a staircase in the middle of the summer. It was about 100 degrees, and insulation was raining down on me. Yeah, that was pretty bad.
Some folks we found on the streets of New York City this week. Well, why be miserable for 40 hours a week if you don't have to be? Laura Dodd is the author of Dig This Gig, and she says now is the perfect time to find or create the kind of work you always wanted. Laura, welcome.
Thank you so much, Tess. Great to be here.
Tell us, what your book involves here. What's this all about?
This is a book. It's a collection of profiles of young adults working in various jobs all over the country, and it's divided by industry. So I look into government jobs and do-good jobs and explore the jobs that are in these particular fields through stories of real 20-somethings working in them. There's also a mentor component. By that, I invited an industry leader to reflect on what it was like when he or she was a 20-something. The reason I did that was because we see these industry leaders who are so advanced in their careers, and it's hard to picture them once struggling too. And I think it gives them a new light and some inspiration to these young graduates who are entering this workplace that, frankly, as we know, is pretty grim right now.
Was it different when they were 20-somethings?
For some, yes. When my parents graduated, I think there was a tendency to go out and get a job, and you stick with it for 30 years, 35 years, 40 years. Now, it's not really a reality because you have to constantly reinvent yourself. And I think a lot of these stories go into how these young adults reinvented themselves and made themselves indispensable.
Can you give us an example from the book?
Sure, of course. This is about a young woman named Erica. She wanted to work in entertainment. So she uprooted from Chicago. She landed in Los Angeles. She got this job as a talent agent's assistant. She knew what her boss wanted before he said it. She observed. She stayed weekends. She knew every single person in the Rolodex. And while it seems minor and it seems silly, it really makes an impact. Because if you can get the coffee right, you can also do other things right. It flows over.
Mm-hmm. The subtitle of your book is Find Your Dream Job or Invent It. When do you do which one?
One of the takeaways is no one's going to tap you on the shoulder and give you your dream job.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not encouraging folks who have an income and have healthcare to go out and quit their jobs. But what I have learned and through these stories is that it takes after hours commitment. You've got to make the time. And honestly, I practice what I preach. I wrote this book while in graduate school.
Hmm.
So when the professor said class dismissed and everyone filed out, I stayed. And I'm only saying that as an example that it takes extra hours beyond everything you'd expect.
Well, the 20-somethings in your book are obviously all working, but what do you say to someone looking for work in this economy? You know, you have a section called Derailed Gigs about 20-somethings who are, you know, out of work and basically doing anything they can. You have the waitress in Colorado who got laid off from a great job in marketing. And this is a situation a lot of people are in. What's your advice?
It's exactly. It doesn't age discriminate, does it?
Right.
Part of the advice through these stories is just keep going. And by that, I mean, if you do get laid off, try to have that conversation with a superior or a boss for some constructive criticism and then get back on it. The other part of this is the parents. It doesn't help to berate and just say, get a job, get a job. You really have to come with ideas and approach it that way. And I think this book gives them that opportunity to see what these kids are thinking and feeling and where they want to go and why they're so ambitious but also paralyzed and wanting to do something that they love.
Laura Dodd is the author of Dig This Gig, Find Your Dream Job or Invent It. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. 15 years ago, writer Daniel Orozco published the short story Orientation, all about life in an office, the politics, the backstabbing, the pointless rules. Orozco escaped the drudgery of the cubicle. Nowadays, he teaches creative writing at the University of Idaho. And Orientation is the title story in his debut collection of short stories. Daniel Orozco, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
You address the reader directly in Orientation, and it's a guided tour of a new office filled with all kinds of salacious tidbits about the coworkers. Could you read that opening paragraph for us?
Sure.
those are the offices and these are the cubicles. That's my cubicle there, and this is your cubicle. This is your phone. Never answer your phone. Let the voicemail system answer it. This is your voicemail system manual. There are no personal phone calls allowed. We do, however, allow for emergencies. If you must make an emergency phone call, ask your supervisor first. If you can't find your supervisor, ask Philip Spears, who sits over there. He'll check with Clarissa Nix, who sits over there. If you make an emergency phone call without asking, you may be let go.
What kinds of jobs were you working when you wrote that story?
I was working office jobs. I worked for years in a human resources office. I worked for the state of California. I was a specialist in a particular employment form that was used statewide. And if you knew how to manipulate, fill out, revise that form, apparently you had a job for life.
Well, as we mentioned, this story came out 15, 16 years ago. So has your view of work changed much since then?
Well, my job has certainly changed a lot. I mean, I teach in university now. I think the office environment that I wrote about and that I experienced is very much different from what I'm experiencing now. I don't know how telling this is about my past history in offices, but I try to avoid administrative stuff as much as possible.
The question might be obvious, but why do you write about work? Yeah, it's characters, right?
Yeah, I have this weird notion that you find out more about somebody at work than you do anywhere else. The office to me is a very unique, dramatic environment. I mean, I've never worked in an office that had less than 20 people in it, and that's a lot of people. That's a lot of dramas. The office is filled with many, many petty and mean, arduous tests. I think when you are tested, that's when you reveal who you are. As a writer, I think those are the most interesting characters, the ones that are under duress.
Did you plan for work to be this connecting theme for your debut collection?
I didn't plan anything about this this debut collection. It has been in the works for so long that it seems to have come together in a sense on its own simply because all of the stories are coming out of me. So there really was no intention making some sort of a commentary about the workplace. I like to think about it perhaps as a commentary about people. And for me, one of the most interesting places to observe people is when they're at work.
That certainly comes through because there's such a humanity in your depiction of these characters, despite the fact that they're in a place that I think a lot of people think is a dehumanizing place.
Yeah, I don't know how I did that, how I work at that, but I do. There is a lot of comedy. There are comic elements, even while things are very sad. But I never want to be making fun of these people. There can be cruelty in these worlds, but I don't want to be cruel about it. My mom and dad worked in factories for years. My mom packed licorice for over 20 years. This is the job that she did to raise me and my brother. And I marvel at that. I mean, there is something she could still come home, take a long bus ride home, come home and be kind of, you know, human and nice. I've never forgotten that. And there is dignity in any work, no matter how dehumanizing it may be.
Daniel Orozco, his debut collection of fiction is called Orientation. You can read the title story on our Big Book blog at marketplace.org/thebigbook. Daniel Orozco, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And that is Marketplace Money for this Labor Day weekend. You can friend us and me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, 10 years after 9/11, survivors recall how the event forced them to prepare for the worst.
When Flight 11 crashed into the North Tower, which is One World Trade Center, the landing gear fell on the roof of the Marriott Hotel, and the hotel actually caught on fire. When you're so close to death, you think about what will happen if you're gone. Since having a child now, we set up life insurance and also having a will in case anything does happen that she's financially prepared.
Marketplace Money is produced by John Buckley with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. I'm Tess Vigeland, wishing you all a day off from your labors and offering thanks to those who are working the holiday. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.